Management or ownership of WGCH Radio.
Look, if you had one shot, one opportunity to seize everything you ever wanted, one moment, would you capture it?
Yo, let's get ready for Noreen Ehrlich, success and relationship coach, who inspires her audience to ignore conventional wisdom in order to create true success. You are now listening to Defy and Hustle with Noreen Ehrlich.
All set, gentlemen? All right. Hi, everybody. This is Noreen, and this is Defy and Hustle Radio, and I have a fantastic show for you this evening. I've got new people at the controls tonight, so we're working things out, but all is well here in town, and I have not just one, but two phenomenal people in the studio. Oh, God. And one of them's going to be trouble. And one of them's causing a little trouble, but we'll get to the bottom of it. We have our first selectman in the town of Greenwich, my guest, Fred Camillo. Thank you, Fred, for being in the studio tonight.
Great to be here, Noreen. And for the audience out there, the person that's going to be trouble would not be me.
It's not. I'm sorry if I made that sound. The person that's going to be a little trouble is, you know him. He is the attorney extraordinaire, Mr. Mickey Sherman, who is blessed us with his appearance this evening. So welcome, Mickey.
Good to be here. But I've got a problem with his title.
Uh-oh.
Let me get that right now. First selectman. I mean, first selectman is the guy who tests their wine at the Homestead Inn.
Oh, God. Oh,
you got to be mayor.
Oh.
People call you mayor anyway.
Yes.
And if you ever run for president, they're not going to say first selectman on the...
Well, if you give me that added job title and description of wine taster over at the Homestead, I will gladly switch over to mayor.
definitely.
I do have to tell people I'm interviewing the mayor tonight because nobody really knows what the first selectman is.
It's a New England term. Go ahead, Bob.
it's freewheeling here tonight in the studio.
Before Greenwich was a town...
It was a borough.
Well, but before it was a town, they needed somebody to come in and decide where the streets were, to select where the streets are going to go. That's what the selectmen
was. Is that
was.
Right?
Yes.
In New England, because yes. You have lots of first selectmen throughout New England. Yeah.
Well, that's what that title was about, at least here in Greenwich that I know about.
That goes back in...
First selectmen stolen from the Indians?
Well, or from the cows. The cow went that way, that's the way the street's going to go.
All right.
There you go. A little bit of history lesson from Bob Small.
That's Bob Small here in the studio over here at WGCH. So, well, welcome everybody. Fred, there's a lot going on. So now you took the position of first selectman.
Mayor
of Greenwich.
So much easier.
You won the race against Jill Oberlander, and that was, so you took the position in November.
Yeah, the election was November, or first week of November, but we were sworn in on December 1st.
On December 1st.
And historically, it was January 1st, but because they wanted the new first selectman and the select board to be involved a little bit more with the budget process, because it really starts around September. Uh-huh. So we were coming in late as the date of December 1st, but it used to be even worse. So that's the reason why they moved it up a month, just to get us a little bit more acclimated and more involved with the budget process.
And the role that you took over previously, Peter Tesi was in the role.
For 12 years.
And
excuse me, isn't the budget process where they just go down to Greenwich Avenue and pick out the first billionaire they see and he writes a check?
What? That used to be. No more. They've been moving.
Mickey's here for comedy.
Tax policy in Hartford, they've been moving to Palm Beach, so we're trying to get them back.
Right. Yeah, I wasn't far off.
Yeah, you were. Yeah, they're, you'd have to go down the main boulevard in Palm Beach. Worth is one of them. And forgot. I don't spend much of my time at Palm Beach like Mickey, but...
I used to.
You used to? All right. Well, all right. So I'm going to talk to Fred for 2 seconds, Mickey, and you can chime
in.
And then you were the Connecticut representative to the state, the 151st district.
Yes.
Yes.
For 11 years.
Okay. Very good. And you're from Kaskop.
Yes. Born and raised.
Born and raised. So that is Fred Camillo. I think everybody knows Fred. I think you're very popular, Fred. Everybody I talk to always says, oh, he's such a good guy.
Okay. Nobody had a question that you would lose.
Oh, that you're nice to say that.
No, I'm serious.
I think Noreen was talking to
you
all my cousins.
You won by a large amount, didn't you?
It was a good hard race that was hard fought.
But the results were incredible.
I was very honored and humbled. But you enter every race thinking you're going to lose. Uh-huh. Even if you think you're going to be okay, you make sure you think you're going to lose, because that motivates you to work. It's like sports. You never want to be outworked. You want to wake up the next day knowing you gave it your all. And that I would promise myself I would never ever be outworked. Uh-huh. But you, in your mind, it's psychological for me. I have friends who are running and who have run before, and they say, "Yep, I'm winning. I'm taking this race," and they'll say that publicly, and it works for some people. I go the other way. I say, you know what? I have the race of my life ahead of me. It's going to be a long shot, and you treat everything like that: sports, business, politics.
Do you know who Martha Coakley is?
In Massachusetts?
Right.
Yes.
She was the DA up there.
Yes. She ran against Scott Brown.
Right. And she ran for senator, right?
Yes.
And she lost, like, by an enormous amount.
Yes.
Which was absurd, because she's been up there for everywhere.
That was Ted Kennedy's seat.
Yeah. That was the same seat. And when they interviewed her saying, why do you think you lost? She her comment was, well, what do you think? I'm going to get up early and give people coffee at the railroad station? Never said, yeah, that's exactly what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
But she actually said that.
Yeah, I think I remember something like that. It was kind of, it's foolish to go in there with that mindset. Nothing's ever promised to anybody. And if you don't treat it, the race and yourself as an underdog and as a long shot, you're really setting yourself up for a setback. I don't care who you are.
Well, the other end of the spectrum is one of my best friends from college was the DA up there for 24 years in Essex County. And when he would run, he'd win. And then the next morning, he'd be out at 6 in the morning on Route 128. Where thanking people.
The first time I ran in 2008 after the election, that Friday night, I went, this was 3 days later, I went back at the old Greenwich and Riverside train stations, and I was thanking people getting off, and they're looking, what are you doing here? What are you, nuts? And it wasn't that many. It was a Friday night. Probably should have done it earlier.
But they will tell other people who will tell other people.
Yeah, they probably forgot now. It was a long time ago. But it's
not likely.
Someone said that Chris Shaza did it, and I think that's where I got the idea from years ago. And I always thought, you see people before, candidates before the race, but rarely do you see them after. So I always send in a thank you letter. Whether you win or lose, you should always, no matter who you are out there,
yeah.
If you lose, send out a thank you letter to everybody, a letter to the editor, that people know. Because a lot of people put time and faith into you, and it's humbling, but you want to make sure that you know that they're appreciated, because you don't get elected alone. You can't do it without other people. And they have to believe what you're saying, and they have to go out and convince other people. So you thanking people is just as much as asking for their support.
But you better have the right attitude, the positive attitude, as you say, and not the attitude that, what do you expect me to do? Get up early and go to the train station?
Yeah, that was shocking. But that was a big...
It became like a headline.
And it was an upset, because at the beginning of the race, no one really knew who Scott Brown was.
Yeah.
And it was Ted Kennedy's seat. Uh-huh. And it was... No one thought a Republican would ever have a shot, but he crisscrossed the state of Massachusetts in his pickup truck, and they did a commercial. And it was an old truck, and I remember one of the parts of the commercial saying, I love this old truck. And you could identify with the guy, as opposed to someone saying that they're not going to get – and there was another – I think it was another part where she wasn't going to – it was raining, and she said, I'm not staying out here in the rain. But when you're running for – you're going to have to be in rain. And
that's like who did it? Who would come up? It was Normandy. And they were having a ceremony down there on the beach. And Trump wouldn't come out to the beach at Normandy because it was raining.
Really?
Yeah.
That's an example where
Normandy wasn't
Normandy, where people
it was there. And one of the comments he made is that, well, it's not that big a deal. A lot of these people were never didn't fight here.
You know, I that's probably not a poor choice of words there, but you have to show people that you're. You're grateful for the opportunity
and that you care,
and the trust,
or at least make it apparent that you care.
Yeah, just thanking people. I mean, people see right through you if you're just thanking them. And for
do they? Do you really think people see right through
you?
I do.
I don't think so anymore.
I think some people see right through you. But were you concerned this year that you, with everything that's going on politically and all the polarization, did you?
Sure.
You really must have been concerned of all years that something might switch in the
Yeah, because they were trying to nationalize the race again. And
all politics is local.
All politics is local, and by going out and doing thousands of doors, and first of all, being out in the community all the time, I always say I don't come at them at election time. I come from them. I'm the same guy I was before I ran. I go to the same diners and delis, and you know, a lot of my friends who I grew up with, the ones that are still here, are still my friends. We still hang out.
Their sentences are almost up. Their sentences are almost up.
Reminds me of your Costcop quote many years ago when we were sitting here in this radio station, and Mickey and I were hosting some show, and I don't even know if I shouldn't repeat it, but it was said in jest. So Mickey announced to the audience, he said, Fred is from Costcob. And Fred, you know what I call people from Costcob? And I said, what, Mickey? He said, clients. And of course, the switchboard lit up.
All right.
Is anybody calling now?
I know. Let's see. We've got Fred Camillo and Mickey Sherman in the studio tonight. So, Fred, you hit the road, right? You're out there. You're all over social media. I certainly see you on social media. Is it a little different strategy this time around? Now that you're first selectman, that you're looking at.
It's a great question. You know, I'm finding now I don't have enough time to even get back to the email. So I go in every Saturday and Sunday. With my dogs, even though there's a policy of no dogs in town hall, but it's off hours. So I take them in there, and I try to return emails on the weekends or late at night, because during the day there's meetings all day long, most on site, but sometimes off campus. And so I'm finding I have a lot less time for social media too. But we're going to I established a weekly email. We call it Community Connections from Fred. A lot of alliteration.
I get the email.
You get it?
Yeah.
So people seem to really like it. And I did that from Hartford every week when we were in session. So we do this every week. It's very popular. We're staying on top of it there. I am on social media every day, but not for very long. I have a couple great young people in Greenwich are going to be interns in the coming months, and one's going to be involved with starting our first ever Instagram page for the first office of the first selectman, and she's going to really revamp the pages we have now on Twitter and Facebook. So we're going to be having even more of a presence, but I've noticed now the difference is the time and former first selectmen have spoken to me and reached out, including Roger Pearson, who called me from Kentucky. Great guy. And Roger served in from 1983 to 1985. And he was telling me his first 3 months, it's tough. And you start to get a better feel for things after 3 months. And then, you know, at the 6 month mark, you're even that more acclimated to it. And it gets better. And you learn how to work your time. But it's being a mayor or a first selectman is. You're on the front line, much more so than even a governor and a president. You are on the front, the CEO that's on the front line of everything, because they can get to you. Where, like, you want to go talk to Ned Lamont, if you don't really know him, you're not, and you go to Prospect Avenue in Hartford, you're not going to get in to see him. It's hard. And the same thing with 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. But your town halls and your city halls are a little bit different. And I think it's meant to be that way. And it's, I would never want to see that change, because the people have access to you. You want that to happen. You want them to know that their government is there for them, and it works for them, and that somebody will always return their calls.
Can I tell my Roger Pearson story?
Absolutely.
Roger Pearson was first selectman for 3 years?
Two years.
And he was not, he wasn't an abrasive guy, but he was just a different guy. And he was driving down Greenwich someplace, and some guy cuts him off. So he pulls over and cuts the other guy off, and they start hollering at each other. Classic road rage. Nobody's throwing fists or anything, but they're screaming at each other. And Roger says, "I'm giving you a ticket. I'm the mayor." And the guy says, you don't have the power to give me tickets. You're just a politician. And the guy says, "By the way, I'm a secret agent for the CIA, so you can't do anything to me." So at this point, they're screaming at each other. The police come, bring them both to the police station. And they explain what happened. The guy says, I'm a CIA agent. He can't arrest me. And Roger's going, I can arrest you, blah, blah, blah. So finally, the police basically throw them both out. But meanwhile, the press gets hold of it, and it's like on the front page the next day. But the epilogue is that the guy who suffered the most was the CIA guy. Turns out he was a CIA guy. He was undercover. So he loses his job.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, God. Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's on the front page of the undercover CIA guy. The other epilogue is that he ends up getting in trouble again and hires me.
Really?
Yeah. It's funny, so.
So you won't name, don't name him.
I barely remember Roger's number.
Yeah, Roger has some great stories and some great advice, and he's a wonderful person.
He was a tennis guy. He was Yvonne Lendl's lawyer, I think.
Was he really?
Yeah, and they did a lot together. And Roger was a good guy. He was really funny.
What kind of advice does he give?
You'd be surprised about how policy-wise, dealing with people, how, you know, what to watch out for when you're out at night and how to conduct yourself. And he mentions, you know, he had to learn some things the hard way and had to change some ways because, you know.
Small town.
Like tonight, I was telling people before when I was leaving my office that I hadn't eaten. And so he was saying that sometimes, you know, like that, you don't eat all day. And if you go out and you have a glass of wine, you may not be drunk, but you're going to be in a weakened state. And you may look like you're, you know, intoxicated. And you got to be very, very careful because people are watching you and they're looking at you. And, you know, you got to hold yourself to a higher standard and you have to be aware of everything. So you have to think twice about everything. And you really have to plan out everything a lot more because, again, people – you walk in a store, people will recognize you from – social media, or right, from the papers, or from an event you spoke at.
Everybody and wants to see somebody slip on a banana peel.
They do, yeah. So you have to really be careful. And I'm a people person, and I'm not going to change that. But I also know that I have to, you know that I'm representing, you know, 60. I'm answerable to 63,000 people. Before it was 24,000. Was still a lot. But it's now a bigger spotlight, and you have to be able to, you know, you don't want to ever do anything that's going to bring any type of negative publicity on your town. So you got to be very careful, and you can't start screaming at CIA agents, right? But Roger's just a terrific.
Wasn't screaming; they were just arguing. And the police handled it properly. They just let everyone said, "Please leave us alone. Take care of yourself."
Roger, as the first selectman, he was the police commissioner.
Yeah.
So can imagine the guy would have to, if the guy ended up arresting the police commissioner.
So funny.
Then he'd have to call you.
He did.
Roger, too.
Yeah, they both did.
Mickey's got stories.
Mickey had a monopoly.
I know.
No, a conflict of interest.
What is your primary job as the first selectman? What is the role of?
So, it encompasses a lot of things. You're the face of the town. You have several departments within your jurisdiction. The big ones are police, fire, public works, and parks and rec. Those are the four biggest. In the case of the police and fire, you are the fire commissioner and the police commissioner. Public works and parks and rec are huge departments. There are also things that affect you every day. You know, you're at the infrastructure, your parks, and your recreational activities. People have a problem; they're going to come to you. You have to balance things. So you listen to complaints, but you also know we have rules and procedures in place, and you don't want to be undermining your department heads, but certainly somebody may call with a gripe that's actually legitimate, mm-hmm. and so you have to make some calls there. But at the end of the day, you have to be very honest and make sure that whatever you decide, that you've in your heart it's the right thing and that you can go to bed at night. I'm going to bed tonight. People are mad at me over, you know, pay-as-you-throw. And I'm trying to explain, you know, and
so
I have to do probably a better job of it. If we did nothing at all, and because now we have to pay another $912,000 for recycling to be carted out of the Greenwich, which before we weren't paying for. But because of the market collapse in China, they're not accepting our recyclables anymore. So all the towns have had to pay. Greenwich was lucky we didn't pay. We were neutral. But we're paying now. And then and next year, that 912 is going to be $1.2 million. And then if you you add that onto the roughly $4 million of the cost for the municipal solid waste or garbage to be carted out, now you're over $5 million. And we're one of the few towns that doesn't have a tipping fee. A tipping fee is when the hauler comes over the scale with the garbage, they weigh it by ton, they pay per by the tonnage. Mm-hmm. I've never liked that, a tipping fee. But now with this, the debate's back again. So I had three options. Do nothing and taxes will increase by – the mill rate would increase 3.42%. If I do –
the mill rate on
– on property.
On properties. Yeah.
And personal property. So that would increase there. And if you break it down, you know, as opposed to what this is going to cost people for in bags, it's in some cases double. The second option is a tipping fee that I just mentioned, which doesn't incentivize you and encourage you to recycle. You're just going to pay the fee. But instead of having the fee for the garbage in your taxes, which is hidden, you only see it when you look at the mill rate.
Right, you're paying for garbage removal regardless.
Right. Here, you charge the hauler, they're going to turn around and pay, you know, transfer that cost on to the individual homeowner. And they're not going to like some of those figures because I've been talking to some of the haulers, and you can't expect them to eat it. It's going to be, you know, a pretty significant hit percentage-wise. And plus, another danger that people don't look at with a tipping fee, if you have a big company, and there's at least one in town here now that has accounts, they're big. They're international. They own their own facility. They can eat this cost. So what's going to happen? They will start to take the customers of the small mom-and-pop haulers who have done such a great job in Greenwich all these years. And little by little, they're not going to be able to sustain it. And then if you only have one or two big companies controlling it, the lack of competition is going to only lead to one thing, increased prices later on because there's going to be no restraints on it, no competitors to keep those prices down. So you got to be very careful with a tipping fee. Raising taxes and doing nothing is not an option to me. But this is the pay as you throw is the only one that offers you personal control over your costs. The less garbage you have, the less you pay. There's two bags. There's one 13 gallons, which is $1.25.
This is you're paying for your bag.
Yeah, yes.
So this is part of the controversy is people are upset because they're going to have to
right.
pay. Do they have to pay for their bags?
Yeah. So
in the recycling.
So they're paying. No, just for garbage.
For garbage across the board.
So right now, if they find out that the mill rate goes up and they do the numbers and they say, well, why? Was there some other opportunity to do something else, other option? And when they find out there was and I didn't do anything and I just sat back and let it happen, they would call me a do-nothing first selectman and they'd be right. So that's off. So it just left the tipping fee or pay-as-you-throw. Well, pay-as-you-throw, you have a 13-gallon bag for $1.25 and a 33-gallon bag for $2. Say you did one bag a month, and the big 33 gallons big. And if you're recycling everything, you're not going to need more than one. And that'd be $8 a month, right? One a month, one a week, $96 a year. If you do like I do the 13 gallons now, and I probably can get it down from there too, but that's going to be $1.25 a week, $5 a month, $60 a year. That's it. So that's the big – and you're not – from that $60, I'm not going to – a little bit of that's going to be chipped off because I'm not paying for those other bags anymore, even though they're cheaper. I'm not going to have to pay for them anymore. So it will bring in the revenue from the bag. So from the $2 bag, the town will keep $1.69 of it. The manufacturer keeps 31 cents. It's a good deal. So we will bring in roughly $2.7 or $2.8 million in revenue from that. So it's actually bringing in revenue, too, to offset the cost of the new recycling charge. Now, if you add the garbage hauling cost and the new recycling cost, it doesn't cover it all, but it significantly cuts into it. But you're reducing, on average, the towns in the 43 states, and that's 43 out of 50 states do this in some way. All of Vermont, half of Massachusetts, and in Connecticut, Stonington does it since 1992. On average, they do about 36% reduction in municipal solid waste, which means that $95 a ton that we're paying for garbage now, that's going to be decreased by a third. So you'll have a little bit more recycling, but recycling is cheaper. That's $65 a ton. So there's a cost savings there too. People have lots of questions. I still have some questions on this that we're getting answered. But I remind people, in 1989, when we went to mandatory recycling, people were flipping out and going crazy. Haulers are going nuts, right? Who's the government to tell me what to do? If I want to throw it away, I'll throw it. Within 3 or 4 months, it was like it never happened. They were used to doing it. All these towns that we're in contact with now, they all say within 6 weeks, there's like 99.6% compliance. 6 weeks is kind of, I think, optimistic. But if they're telling me 6 weeks, who am I to doubt?
6 weeks for people to get over
to
it.
To get over it. Yes.
Not get over it. Sorry, folks. It's my words, not his. But meaning that you'll get accustomed to it, just like anything else.
So absolutely.
It's like you get accustomed to it, and it doesn't seem like it becomes natural.
I didn't learn this stuff.
What's that?
How do you learn this stuff?
I knew a lot of it already because I was in recycling years ago, and I paid attention to it even after I left the industry many, many years ago. But it's if you're not really wealthy and you have to watch all your paycheck, you pay attention to these things and you start to break down a lot of what the cost would be, and you make a choice. Well, do I run to the dump myself with the garbage? But if you go to a tipping fee, that you're going to have to charge everybody who goes down that dump, because it's not fair to charge just the people who have haulers. So it's a complicated thing, but
utilities. Sorry, you said
the more you use it,
then you're going to pay more. If you don't use a lot of it, and it's also an incentive to not
Can
to
I ask
so
a question?
Garbage.
Yes.
Help me understand a little bit about this. We're paying to dump the garbage to offset what it cost us to get rid of the recyclable. Is that true? Am I saying that right?
Yes, but you have to look at it in the aggregate. So whatever it was, if this is bringing in 2.7 and say it's like 5 million in the aggregate, I'm just throwing the number out there, it's not covering the whole cost. But if we don't do anything, then it's a $5 million hit. And then your taxes go up even more. So, you know, this is the only one that offers personal control over the cost.
So where will our recycling be taken? It's just out of curiosity.
It depends. I mean, we take the garbage right now to Peekskill, and I think another place nearby. We don't go to the Hartford facility, but that's weighing on us here too, because that facility is in rough shape, and it needs lots of money to be fixed up. And, of course, there's not many landfills. No one wants the stuff. So you really have to do your best to get the garbage, get this the waste stuff. Another name for pay-as-you-throw, P-A-Y-T, is SMART. Save money and reduce trash. And I think we have to start selling that a little bit more too, because we're also going to be doing a pilot program on food scraps in April. Voluntary. But you could do compost in the backyard, or you could dump it off at the dump, at the transfer station, or you can have your hauler take it. But that's going to take a lot, especially if you're cooking. You know, the eggshells, the meat bones, coffee grinds, that will go in there. So I'm actually excited, because now that's the one thing I don't do. So that's a challenge to me. And I'm looking, I'm going to get even more out of there going forward. And if I want to keep a little bit to compost in my backyard, I can do that too.
Mm-hmm. Fred, if this is exciting to you, you may want to consider raising the bar on excitement.
Well, I'm trying to go down and watch the Yankees for a couple games of spring training.
That's good.
Does that get me in the right direction?
Yeah.
It's exciting to me because it's to me, I know it's the right thing to do, but also it's a personal challenge. I recycle a lot of stuff, but I have very little garbage. But I don't cook as much as a lot of people. I'm not home at night, so. For those who cook, this food scraps is going to be a very big thing because, they'll be able to really get it down, the amounts, significantly if they do this.
Is the town going to provide security for Tom Brady?
I don't know. I still don't know. It depends.
That's a fairly serious question.
Has he actually moved in?
As a good friend of mine said, the only two people know, the listing broker and the selling broker.
Oh, no.
Yeah. You talk to somebody, he definitely did. You talk to somebody else, no, he didn't. Don't know. Greg Hill's show in Boston called me as I was going to work, and they were on Bluetooth, and they're interviewing me about what type of neighborhood it is. Is it a teardown? Is it, you know, how are the Jet and Giant fans going to treat them? What kind of car was I driving? Was I being driven to work? It's one of those. It's a sports talk show, but they were ragging on Greenwich a little bit.
Let me give you a quick short story on sports. I was in a golf tournament in Westchester where I forgot who the sponsor was, but it was a bunch of athletes in it as well. And it was half sponsored by ESPN Radio. And I got up to drive the ball. And as I'm getting ready to hit, on my IFB, they get in and say, "Mickey, we have a question for you. We need to go to you right now." I go, I can't talk. I've got I'm teeing you off. I said, "You know what? Hold on. What's the question?" And it was some esoteric question. So I got just the guy for you. The caddy's standing right there. He's like 15 years old. what's your name? Good, Chris. How old are you? 15. What do you think about this subject? Okay, Chris, I want you to take the phone, and some people are going to ask you questions, and then you're going to be on the radio, so then you got to call your parents and tell them when this airs. Okay. And then I got the ESPN people. Okay, Chris is going to answer your questions. He's really knowledgeable. I think he used to be with another network as well. He's very versatile. But he can answer it. And then for 15 minutes, this kid answered questions. I got him a copy of the tape and everything. I sent it to him. It was so damn funny.
Did he ever go into broadcasting?
No, I think he became a drug addict.
I was going to say, I thought you were going to say he became a client.
No, he did. He did. I don't know.
That was the next step.
Yeah.
All right.
Good stories.
Yeah, no. Mickey's got tons.
I do the counterpoint to your stories. you're there to address social justice. I'm going to get a quick laugh.
All right. Well, speaking of social justice, what about the traffic police on the avenue? This is something else everybody's upset about, that you can't take that away.
Yeah.
My question is, are you going to pardon the people who get arrested crossing over to Starbucks without permission of the police?
No, not pardon them there. I'll pardon them if they go across the other way. You know, the mom and pop stores. I'm not in Starbucks. No, just kidding. Every first selectman in the last 50 years has tried this, I believe. And one,
to eliminate the traffic
police?
Yeah,
because the police don't want to be there.
They don't?
No, they don't want to be there. I've heard that we've lost potential recruits because when they apply to the departments, they always go to a bunch of towns, take the test, and I've heard that when they hear they may have to be on the avenue directing traffic for 2 years, they say, no way. To me, the police have always, I mean, even a former chief wrote in, was interviewed saying they've always had a better idea of deployment to enhance public safety. So people get the wrong idea, thinking, they're there for public safety. Well, they're only there from 9 to 5. So before and after 9 to 5 during the week, there's nobody there. And there's still people, especially in the summer, going back and forth. Sundays, there are no cops at all directing traffic. It's also the biggest vehicular traffic day of the week. It's also the day with the least amount of accidents.
Least amount of accidents.
The least, which I never knew until a couple weeks ago. Yeah. So it's not even an issue in that case. Now, what about protecting the public, like if there's a robbery. Well, they normally wouldn't leave their posts anyway. They would call it in. We do have undercover cops all around, but I want to have a uniform presence. I'd rather see somebody walking the beat again. Mm-hmm. I think that people would love that more. And I talked to some merchants who called me and said, you know, leave the cops on there directing traffic. But when I tell them this other, they say they prefer that. Mm-hmm. So I have to, you know, explain it a little bit better. But also, my idea, and we're going over the numbers, would be after if you redeploy them, take out the stop signs at the intersection and put up these old vintage stoplights from like the early 20th century.
Cool.
It'll be cool. And you know, it'll be ADA compliant for the visually impaired. It'll be noises and alerting the people about the traffic conditions. I also put $200,000 in as a capital project to bump out the curb at Arch Street and Greenwich Avenue to make the width smaller, which would also be helpful for pedestrian safety. There's a lot of things in there. So if people – when people hear about what they're going to get rather than what's going away, there's a few people who just said – like a good friend of mine who's going to testify against this at the VET hearings. He said, I'm just going to testify against it. I think it's good for our image. And that – again, that's a personal
– I don't think that bodes well for the people upstate.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Right. But again, in this person's opinion, it means a lot to have. So I get that. And again, I'm a townie. I love tradition. All things being equal, if the police didn't mind being there and there was other it wouldn't even be a thought. But when they tell you there's better ways to protect the public, if I say, well, I don't want to do anything because I'm afraid of public opinion, then the people made a mistake in November.
Or the way it looks.
The way it looks, yeah. So, again, I'm open to all ideas and thoughts, but you have to put these things out, and you got to be willing to discuss them, and you got to keep up there and keep the discussion going, because if you turn tail and run at the hint of opposition, you're done. You will never get anything done.
How do you get along with the cops? Because that's always a big problem.
Great.
In every city.
They're great.
For example, in Stanford, they pick the best, nicest, most competent, effective guy on the job. They make him chief. And within 20 minutes, everybody hates him. Is it the unions are pissed off at him? The press has got it in for him? It's amazing. It's like a death warrant.
You know, in Greenwich, not always, but traditionally, there's always been a great relationship, I think, between the first selectman and the police and the fire. Great guys and get along well with the chiefs. They do a super job protecting us, you know, Greenwich's finest and Greenwich's bravest. But, you know, sometimes, you know, maybe when it comes to, contract time, there may be some disagreements. But all in all, they just do such a great job. And people, on Christmas Day, I went around to all the fire departments to thank them for the guys that were on call. And I also went to the police station because there was a couple of people there. And I was trying to remind people as I went around the town after Christmas, saying, remember, you know, people say, oh, you know, they make too much or, you know, they get lots of time off. Well, they will work on weekends. They will work nights. They will work on holidays. They have, for the most part, an unset schedule. It's hard to make, you know, and plus there's a certain amount of danger in those jobs. So I think the overwhelming majority of the people in town appreciate the job they do. I really do.
There's a built-in heartache factor, is what I would call it, is that so often some of the cops, they don't have the money to live in Stanford, in Greenwich. Yeah. And so they have to live up Shelton or in the Valley or someplace.
So Mickey is right. So when we grew up in Greenwich, right, when Mickey and I grew up here, most of the cops lived here. When the real estate...
Our friends were the cops' kids.
Yep. And if a cop ever picked you up, not that it was they picked me up, but if a cop ever picked you up, he drove you home to your father, that was a bigger punishment than if you got arrested back then.
But what you see now, though, is these people, these cops who live out of town, and they drive down Greenwich Avenue, and there's 42 Lamborghinis there. They're like an occupational force, which is sometimes breeds a very negative connotation.
Yeah, I mean, before, like you said, if the cop was your neighbor or your cousin or... You know, you actually, in some cases, it was worse because you didn't – you acted up. You may not have even seen them, but word would have got back to your father.
Right.
But the ones who, you know, today it's just tough because of the real estate market. So I don't blame them. They go where they can live and afford a decent place to live. And, the commute can be tough depending on where they're coming from.
And they do a lot of side jobs, which is helpful.
Yes, very helpful.
Well, Connecticut's well set up for that, though, so that they can be positioned at these work sites directing the traffic, for instance. I'm afraid we're getting back to that, directing traffic. But I have to ask you, though, you were saying that the police chief, I assume, was telling you this, that there is a better way to protect the pedestrians at the intersections. What is the better way?
Just like what I was saying, you could do walking the beat. If it's warm weather, you have a guy on a bicycle.
So it's just visibility is what he's saying. I think I can agree because I know over here at the intersection with Lewis – the times that there's a policeman just standing on the corner kind of watching what's happening, I notice the traffic calms right down.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Are you familiar with the Comstat program? From New York?
New York, yeah, with Giuliani and Bill Bratton.
Right. That's
what is this? What are we talking about?
Comstat. By computer, they figured out where all the crime is, and they've just piled police officers right there. Bratton is like a close friend of mine.
Is he really?
Yeah. I went out to L.A. when he was sworn in.
Is he still out there now?
No, he's out of L.A. He's now did a term here in New York again, mm-hmm. and now he's just working privately.
Was Bill Bratton the one that did the broken windows theory with Rudy?
Yes.
So the broken windows theory...
Rudy hated him.
Yeah. Well, they're strong personalities.
Bill got all the Time magazine cover and everything.
Yeah.
You met Bill.
I didn't mean it.
Well, the broken windows theory goes something like this, where if someone's walking down the street at night and they look up and there's 17 windows are broken on the building, it doesn't take much to pick up a rock and break the 18th. But if there's nothing broken, it takes a lot more courage to break the first one. So the broken windows theory was when you see something broken, you fix it immediately. I have the same view with the graffiti. luckily, we don't have much in Greenwich, but there is some, and I want to start addressing that in the warmer months with a plan to. And if you see something go up, to immediately take it down, and not let it stay.
It's sort of a play on the
broken windows theory.
The broken windows thing supposedly gives people a feeling of confidence and approval if it's fixed automatically.
Oh yeah.
The other thing is, remember Kitty Genovese case?
Who was buried in Darien, Connecticut?
Come on, really?
She was murdered in Kew Gardens, Queens in 1964.
27 people heard her screaming for her life as she was being stabbed to death. And nobody called the police. Nobody came down to help her.
And that was because, and then after that, that's where 911 came from.
Yeah.
They implemented a 911 system. But she was living there. She was, I think, bartending, came home late from work, and then some guy followed her and murdered her on the street in Kew Gardens, New York. Her family had moved to New Canaan. She's buried in St. John's Cemetery in Darien. Yeah. A very sad story. But if you Google it, there's been movies, I think, and books.
But they've actually coined a name for the syndrome, that they are more likely to be helped if one person sees you being hurt. If 10 people see you, they're all going to say to each other. Or say,
somebody else will take care of it.
They'll take care of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I bet you it's worse now than it was back in the 1960s because everybody's so out of it now.
Yeah.
Well, I was talking – when I told people I was having you on the show, but general when we're talking about Greenwich, I will tell you that women love it here because it's safe. That's the first word. So it's just something that maybe men don't have a full appreciation for, but as a woman, you just want to know that you're safe. It takes one – one item out of your mind that you just have in your subconscious.
I'm glad you brought that up. Because we've heard, especially from women, but from men too, when they get off the train and they go under the underpass here in Greenwich and other places for 95 and the railroad tracks, it's dark. So we're going to be filling out encroachment permits with Connecticut Department of Transportation. We've already spoken to them, and they said they would grant it. So we can clean it up, light it up, maybe put some murals in some places of Greenwich Bay scenes, maybe do some projection scenes where light goes up on the newly painted wall with a scene maybe of a lighthouse or whatever. So you now you're going to – the public safety, where there's light, there's going to be less crime. Thank God we haven't had any incidents, but it's dark, and we don't want any incidents, so we want to be more proactive. So that's on the to-do list, but I definitely agree. People do – one of the reasons why they move here and stay here is because of the public safety element.
What's going on – okay, you look at Greenwich Avenue. I know you're not in charge of the economy, but there was supposed to be some public-private work being done down by the train station potentially to – I guess, and send people to come here to town as more tourists and something to make the avenue come back to life, because it seems like the companies don't stay in business. So any ideas, anything to really spark things up here?
Sure. So we have an idea, a vision. It's a 10-year vision of repurposing some of the buildings in town, including on the avenue, uh-huh. and renovating some of them with private money. So P3s, public-private partnerships. Uh-huh. Already in contact with a bunch of people, implementing a town properties committee that's going to start meeting any day now. We've already met informally, but the committee hasn't met in full to look at these properties. But also, I want to do a waterfront destination, a waterfront district, and it starts with Roger Sherman Baldwin Park, right. connecting Greenwich Avenue to the waterfront. So we have it in the budget this year. To relocate, it's going to take about a year probably, but to relocate the Parks and Rec operation on the water, take down those garages there, expand the park. We're going to do an RFP probably in the coming days for a designer to go there and give us an idea, because it's a lot more complicated than just, you know, tearing down buildings and expanding the park.
You have to move the service.
How did you ever get the skateboard park through?
I was on the Parks Board then. That was hard.
I can't imagine. I used to be a lawyer for the Wetlands Commission years ago, and I know the tenor of the conversation with people to try to do something, and I just couldn't believe that they were able to get a skateboard park in there.
Yeah, it wasn't easy, but that's going to stay under the new vision.
That's great.
The Bruce Museum is doing a terrific renovation. They've raised most of their money already. So we're going to tie all that in, and then the Greenwich Plaza that Noreen mentioned is very complicated. So the six-person, maybe seven or eight, but there's six people that will, I guess, going to be announcing early next week now. We have the six people on this committee that's going to be taking a look at the deal and advising the Office of First Selectmen. Ultimately, you know, we're going to have legal counsel, you know, looking at it. But we want – last time this proposal came up where they want – the owners of the Greenwich train station, the only privately owned train station in Connecticut, want to renovate it. And they also they also want to do a public park there, a public benefit. So they said, well, if it comes to, say, $15 million in – you know, a trade-off with that for that, give us the air rights for 1 and 2 Greenwich Plaza, which they're 47% owner, we're a 53% owner. 1 and 2 Greenwich Plaza are those two buildings near the railroad station that blocked the view of the Sound when they went up in 1967, because you used to be able to see Long Island Sound from all parts of the avenue. So they gave them a 90-year lease back then. Well, in 67, it's 52 years ago. Now, right, we're 53 years ago. We're getting close, and now it's starting to affect the leases there. So the developer who owns the train station and is part owner of 1 and 2 Greenwich Plaza, literally the line dissects the buildings, right? So what do you do with this? And they want to clear up the title so they'll be able to get full rental value again on their leases, because no one wants to commit to a long-term lease not knowing what's going to happen in 2057. So the committee has public sector people, private sector people, lawyers, financial people, people who have had or been in commercial real estate and have dealt with air rights before. Mm-hmm. Complicated. Certainly around here, we don't see this issue, but you see it in the city.
In the city, yeah.
So really a diverse group, but the skill sets are tailor-made for this. And the last time this was brought up last year, I think the former first selectman was unfairly attacked because people who knew about it claimed they didn't know about it and became a political issue during the campaign.
Didn't know about what?
That there was this idea that we were going to sell them the air rights for this $15 million.
Oh, I see.
And so we wanted to avoid that this time. And again, a lot of the charges that were made, were way off base. But knowing what happened, we put people very diverse as the group, politically, political affiliation wise,
environmentally.
Just everything, skill sets, backgrounds, people who are some people are on it who took a very negative view of the deal last time are on it. Uh-huh. We have some other people on it that are really good, open-minded and think outside the box. And you want them in the room together. You want them looking at all the evidence and facts and bounce these contrasting ideas and visions off each other, and then come up with a solution that they can certainly give to the Office of the First Selectman, and we can look at it. And again, it's non-binding, but it's just another set of eyes looking at it that have had experience in some cases with these types of deals.
I think that would really, really, really shift the image and the branding of Greenwich, because it's such a phenomenal community and great location, but you get off at the train station and it looks outdated.
A little dumpy. Yeah, so a little dumpy. we want to get something done there. And I tell people, some people say, "Oh, I don't like it." Then come up with a solution. Don't tell me no. Give me your solution. We're all about ideas and solutions. I don't want to hear no because I don't like it, or no because it goes against my sense of aesthetics.
Just complaining for the sake of complaining.
Gary
Delabate
still on the board of
Gary Delabate still on the board of recreation. Yeah,
that's great.
Great guy. Great guy. There's a guy. He comes to the table with ideas and solutions. You may or may not agree with them, but he comes there and offers, and that's the beauty about Greenwich. Is it's civic-minded, people are very civic-minded. We're second to none when it comes to civic involvement. And you have people like Gary who could be doing a lot of other things but choose to spend their time for the betterment of our town.
You a Howard Stern fan?
I never listened to him, but I remember when he was on TV years ago and I saw a couple episodes, but Gary's my connection to this show.
Oh, he's that's funny. it's a funny show. It's a little trouble, but it's a funny show.
Mickey would be a good guest on that show.
You'd
be a good guest on the show.
I've done it.
You have?
Yeah.
All right.
There you go. So you could YouTube and find Mickey and Howard Stern.
You did Howard Stern?
Yeah.
No, you didn't.
On a news thing.
All right. I got to close up the show, but gentlemen, you feel free to come back. All right, folks, this is Noreen Ehrlich signing off with my guest tonight, Fred Camillo, and the surprise guest, Mickey Sherman.
Surprise.
And it was wonderful talking to you this evening. Come on back next week. And thank you so much, Fred, and good luck with everything.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it. And I come back, I'll co-host again. I'll be a co-guest with Mickey.
he took over. And thanks, Mickey.
And
thanks for swinging by.
And Tom Brady.
And Tom Brady. And Bob Small. Take care. Take care, everybody.
AM 1490 and FM 105.5 WGCH Greenwich.
Debate newcomer taking heat over virus. I'm Barbara Cusack. Multi-billionaire Michael Bloomberg makes his debut as he takes to the stage tonight in Las Vegas in his first 2020 Democratic presidential debate.
With all the hype about it, you think he's riding in on a white tiger flanked by showgirls, but it's just him. Aaron Call, director of debates at the University of Michigan, says not only will the other candidates be taking aim at Bloomberg, but he has to introduce himself.
He used to be a Republican.